TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Radioactivity from Madame Curie to Fukushima. Here's Dick Gregory after Three Mile Island.
What we're doing here today is more important than the Vietnamese War. It's more important than dealing with racism, than dealing with sexism, than dealing with hunger, because I can feel hunger. I can see war. I can feel racism. I can feel sexism. I cannot see radiation. I cannot smell radiation. I cannot hear radiation. I look around one day and I am dead.
Radioactivity, an electronic music band whose name Kraftwerk translates into power station, put out the album Radioactivity in 1975, composed around a ticking Geiger counter and the Morse code warning for radioactivity. It bridged the art scene and the huge anti-nuclear movement of that time. The campaigns for nuclear disarmament, the movements against nuclear power stations, and the partly successful efforts to stop nuclear bomb testing, they all could relate to the simple statement that radioactivity is now in the air for you and me and creates a new and permanent danger for us all. And indeed, as Kraftwerk says, Madame Curie discovered radioactivity and is credited for having coined the term and developed a theory of radioactivity. She invented techniques for isolating radioactive isotopes, and she discovered two elements, polonium and radium. She named polonium after her home country, Poland, that she had left in 1891 at age 24 to study and live in France. Marie Curie was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize, the only woman to win in two fields, and the only person to win in multiple sciences. She was also the first woman to become professor at the University of Paris. Madame Curie died in 1934 in a sanatorium in France of aplastic anemia, a blood disorder. She was so poisoned by radiation that her body's bone marrow no longer made enough new blood cells. In spite of her brilliance as a scientist, she had no notion of the danger of radiation. She wrote in her diary, "One of our joys was to go into our workroom at night. We then perceived on all sides the feebly luminous silhouettes of the bottles containing our products. It was really a lovely sight, and one always new to us." Along with her husband and collaborator, Pierre, Marie Curie lived her life awash in radiation. After more than 100 years, Marie Curie's scientific papers and even her cookbooks are still radioactive and are kept in lead-lined boxes in France's Bibliothèque Nationale. You have to sign a waiver and put on protective clothing to study them. And given that the most common isotope of radium, radium-226, has a half-life of 1,600 years, Madame Curie's papers will remain radioactive for another 16,000 years. Today, the notion of the danger of radioactivity is more widespread, but the problem is that our senses do not have the ability to recognize radiation, and our bodies often mistake dangerous radiation for beneficial elements. Our thyroids, for example, can't tell the difference between normal and necessary or radioactive iodine. On March 28, 1979, a nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island, Pennsylvania, had a partial meltdown. A huge controversy developed as to what radionuclides had been released and what the health effects might be. As testimony to the vibrant anti-nuclear movement that existed in the 70s, only 5 weeks after the Three Mile Island accident, 70,000 people from all over the country came to Washington, D.C. for a rally to stop nuclear power. Among those who came on stage were Graham Nash, Jackson Brown, Ralph Nader, Jane Fonda, whistleblower, nuclear chemist, and M.D. John Goffman, and even California Governor Jerry Brown. The comedian Dick Gregory made an amazing and inspiring point.
First, let me say, let us kind of take a one quick moment of silence for all of those folks that have died already, that was led to believe that they died from natural causes. And let's include in all those poor folks when the Three Mile Island plant blew, didn't have the money to run, so had to stay there and listen to those lies and make believe it was the truth. Let's have a moment's silence for them. Thank you. I had the press was asking me a few minutes ago, when did I first get involved with nuclear power? It was the first time when I went to get an X-ray and the doctor said, take a deep breath, hold it, and I looked up and he was fleeing down the hall. I knew then something was wrong. That a lot of folks been asking me today, where's all the black folks? Where's all the Indians? Where's all the poor folks? When we came to Washington, D.C., in the early days of the civil rights movement, we did not look around and question where the white folks was. The ones that was with us was there because we brought them. And I say to you from here on in, if you wonder where they are, then damn it, bring them with you, or don't question where they are when you get here. And I tell you something else. I would rather look out here and see 200,000 to 300,000 predominantly white folks saying to this racist institution, we've had enough, than 300,000 to 400,000 black folks, because they'll listen to you before they'll listen to us. Understand that. What we're doing here today is more important than the Vietnamese War. It's more important than dealing with racism, than dealing with sexism, than dealing with hunger, because I can feel hunger. I can see war. I can feel racism. I can feel sexism. I cannot see radiation. I cannot smell radiation. I cannot hear radiation. I look around one day and I am dead. Somewhere, you have to. Somewhere. You have to. So I say to you today, when you leave here, you have to give radiation an odor. You have to give radiation a sound. You have to give radiation a smell. So go back into your communities and be willing to go to jail if it comes to that. Because I'd rather see you in jail with the jails filled up then the graveyard's running over. We have a choice. We've been told that if we close the nuclear plants down, we'll have brownouts. We'll have blackouts. I would rather have brownouts and blackouts than people outs. And finally, I say to you, if we in this country have used up all of our legitimate energies, and the only way we can survive is with illegitimate energies, then I say, damn it, go to bed at night when the sun goes down and wake up in the morning when it comes up. That's what it's going to come to. That's what it's going to have to come to. I say to you to understand, and this is what the president better understand, and this is what Schlesinger better understand, and this is what Congress better understand. There's an energy force out here today that will make them petty energy forces that they build in look like Mickey Mouse. The difference is, are you willing to go back and use this raw, naked power? About 10 years ago in California, I stood in front of a crowd like this, and I knew that you had the power to end that war in Vietnam. And so I vowed 10 years ago that I would not eat any more solid food until the war was over in Vietnam. And a lot of folks thought I was going to die, but I knew how much power you had. And I know you have the power to do that. God bless you. Peace be with you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. No more nukes. No more nukes. No more nukes. We can win this fight. We will win this fight. We must win this fight.
That was Dick Gregory on May 6, 1979. The Three Mile Island accident enhanced the credibility of anti-nuclear groups. They had predicted an accident, and it triggered protests around the world. The largest demonstration was held in New York City in September 1979 and involved 200,000 people. In spite of the huge numbers, the worldwide reach, and the eloquent arguments, nuclear power was not abandoned. As each subsequent nuclear power accident and also each industrial production of radioactivity through oil drilling and fracking and mining, each leak at radioactive dumps, and each crash of a satellite with nuclear power on board increase the amounts of often long-lived radioactive material spread around the world, the question becomes how to detect and protect ourselves from the radioactivity that is already all around us, while ending the processes that produce this dangerous material. Recognizing radioactivity remains elusive, but for one thing, a Geiger counter can make it audible. When I first visited the Geiger counter builder Dan Scythe in Sebastopol, California, both of us had a double take. We had met before, but where? It turned out that I had interviewed Dan 20 years earlier in an old school bus outside the gates of the Nevada test site. We were attending the annual gathering organized by the late Western Shoshone elder Corbin Harney. Friends and I were running an unlicensed radio station for the camp of maybe 500 who had come to support the Western Shoshone and protest the nuclear devastation and poisoning of their treaty land. Dan Scythe began building Geiger counters explicitly at first to give to people who had been damaged by radiation and were unable to prove it. His first Geiger counter went to Joe Harding. Joe had been denied medical benefits for health problems related to his job at a poorly managed uranium fuel plant in Kentucky. Later, Dan was part of an effort to build and donate Geiger counters for people around Chernobyl. Other communities Dan Seith and his colleagues have worked with include Three Mile Islanders, Marshall Islanders, Native people from Lakota, Navajo, and Cherokee nations and lands, also Native peoples from Kazakhstan who are affected by nuclear weapons testing. Dan worked with people harmed by uranium mining, milling, processing, and nuclear weapons development, including the Hanford Reservation in Washington State, Rocky Flats in Colorado, Lawrence Livermore National Lab in California, Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee, Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico. And Dan Seith worked at more reactor sites, including Pilgrim in Massachusetts, Seabrook in New Hampshire, where he installed a community monitoring system to track the emissions of a nuclear power plant during so-called normal operations. Then he did monitoring work at Kerr-McGee in Oklahoma, Sellafield, England, Cap de la Hague, France, Cherbourg, France, Moraroa Atoll, Tahiti, Hawaiian Islands, and other places that Dan told me he loved and are memorable and some that he'd like to forget. And he said, the communities and individuals I have worked with over those 36 years have often not been given full disclosure or assistance when nuclear activities have affected their health. End quote. So many locations all over the world, all just from one Geiger counter builder's experience. Most of them remaining a permanent problem into the future due to the longevity of radiation, and many of them affecting vast areas beyond each particular hotspot. So it was normal for Dan Seith to pack up and leave for Japan soon after the Fukushima disaster began unfolding. With 7 functioning Geiger counters and radiation detectors and a suitcase full of parts, he arrived in Tokyo in April 2011. Very immediately, his Geiger counters found high readings around some schools and protected children who were about to be sent into their radioactive playgrounds. By April 2011, it had become apparent that TEPCO and the Japanese government either did not have radiation measurements or, in many cases, did not disclose the results, and the need for a people's monitoring system became apparent. When Fukushima first broke, Dan's small workshop in Sebastopol was overrun with requests for Geiger counters. His business usually builds to order and does not even keep a large parts inventory, some of which come from Japan. Some threatened to sue him if he did not sell them a Geiger counter immediately. So Dan Seith had to set priorities, and his company, International Medcom, put in extra shifts and supplied Geiger counters to those willing to share the data rather than using them for their own safety and benefit. They also decided to treat Fukushima as a humanitarian crisis. So now the question became how best to do the sharing and make the results transparent. To Dan's surprise, a conference had been called under the title New Media versus Traditional Media. Apparently, Jori Ito from the MIT Media Lab and the newly established Safecast had initiated a conversation how to make radiation data collection work for Fukushima and how to expand into a global effort. Their plan was to figure out how new internet-based media could deal with accidents and public health crises and get information directly to and from the affected people.
And so everybody got together when the conference was over, put our heads together, what can we do? So we started whipping things together, and I gave them every Geiger counter that we could find. What they did is put them into these boxes, these penguin pelican cases that you can get over at Best Buy and places like that, and then hook them up to Arduino boards. We had the Tokyo hackerspace community behind us. And these people are like really radical, you know, do-it-yourself people. And the worldwide hacker space movement kind of got behind us. And pretty soon it was kind of like a Frederick Pohl science fiction story, because we were pulling these things together and hacking together ways of sharing the data. And things were happening every night working on these things. So you strap this to a car and you drive, and it's got a GPS receiver on it. People have carried these into the zone, people that work in the zone. People have deployed them on bicycles. They've been given to towns. And the data is all published on the web.
That was Dan Seith from International Medcom in Sebastopol, California. Dan continues to work with Safecast since it was established, and he has built two new special Geiger counters that work well with the site, the Onyx and the B-Geigy. Both come out of the growing open source and make communities. They easily store and transmit data on the internet, even on Twitter or via an iPhone application. The B-Geigy sends mobile data with built-in GPS coordinates. In addition to having difficulties detecting radiation, we come across efforts to minimize the effects of radiation on life. Yes, we all live in radiation from space and rocks and the sun, some of which can also make us sick. But today, we're facing an international industrial and military-driven effort to make and spread forms of radiation that never existed before, and that will continue to be dangerous, depending on the isotope, for minutes, years, hundreds, or even thousands of years. Nobody explains that better than Stephen Starr, senior scientist with Physicians for Social Responsibility. On the second anniversary of the Fukushima tragedy, he said the following about cesium-137.
Long-lived radionuclides such as cesium-137 are something new to us as a species. They did not exist on Earth in any appreciable quantities during the entire evolution of complex life. Although they are invisible to our senses, they are millions of times more poisonous than most of the common poisons we are familiar with. They cause cancer, leukemia, genetic mutations, birth defects, malformations, and abortions at concentrations almost below human recognition and comprehension. They are lethal at the atomic or molecular level. They emit radiation, invisible forms of matter and energy that we might compare to fire, because radiation burns and destroys human tissue. But unlike the fire of fossil fuels, the nuclear fire that issues forth from radioactive elements cannot be extinguished. It is not a fire that can be scattered or suffocated, because it burns at the atomic level. It comes from the disintegration of single atoms. Thus, radioactivity is a term which indicates how many radioactive atoms are disintegrating in a time period. We measure the intensity of radioactivity by the rate of disintegrations and the energy they produce. Sometimes these man-made radionuclides are compared to naturally occurring radionuclides, such as potassium-40, which is always found in bananas and other fruits. However, this is a false comparison, since naturally occurring radioactive elements are very weakly radioactive. Highly radioactive fission products, such as cesium-137 and strontium-90, emit 10 to 20 million times more radiation per unit volume than does potassium-40. So which one of these would you rather have in your bananas? It is, in fact, the amount of cesium-137 deposited per square kilometer of land that defines the degree to which an area is classified as being too radioactive to work or live. One may get an idea of the extreme toxicity of cesium-137 by considering how little of it is required to make a large area of land uninhabitable. The lands that were grossly contaminated by the destruction of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant are classified by the number of curies of radiation per square kilometer. The 1,100-square-mile uninhabitable exclusion zone that surrounds a destroyed Chernobyl reactor has greater than 40 curies of radioactivity per square kilometer. For those more familiar with square miles, that would be 104 curies per square mile. Consider again that 1 gram of cesium-137 has 88 curies of radioactivity. Thus, as little as 1/3 of a gram of cesium-137 made into microparticles, distributed as a smoke or gas over an area of 1 square kilometer, will make that square kilometer uninhabitable. Less than 2 grams of cesium-137, a piece smaller than an American dime, if made into microparticles and evenly distributed as a radioactive gas over an area of 1 square mile, will turn that square mile into an uninhabitable radioactive exclusion zone. Central Park in New York City can be made uninhabitable by 2 grams of microparticles of cesium-137. Hard to believe, isn't it? Remember, these nuclear poisons are lethal at the atomic level. There are as many atoms in 1 gram of cesium-137 as there are grains of sand in all the beaches of the world. Many of the 104 U.S. commercial nuclear reactors and power plants have more than 100 million curies of cesium-137 in their spent fuel pools. This is many times more than the spent pools at Fukushima.
That was Stephen Starr. He's senior scientist with Physicians for Social Responsibility and Clinical Laboratory Science Program Director at the University of Missouri. He was recorded on March 11, 2013 at the New York Academy of Medicine. This part of his talk is an excerpt of the TUC radio series on the Fukushima Symposium, held on the second anniversary of the tragedy at Fukushima. This was a tribute to Dick Gregory in the context of radioactivity from Madame Curie to Fukushima. Included is material from TUC radio's nuclear collection and the Pacifica Archives. In late August of 2017, the comedian Dick Gregory was remembered for his extraordinary work in the civil rights and anti-war movements, and his concerns for health and good food were praised. Not that much was said about his early opposition to nuclear power. The Dick Gregory clip you heard was recorded at the 70,000-people-strong Washington, D.C. rally. It came together only 5 weeks after the Three Mile Island partial meltdown on March 28, 1979. The demand was to shut down all nuclear power plants, which would have saved us from Chernobyl and Fukushima. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.